This is a Triple J podcast.
Hello, it's Lucy Smith with you for another episode of Science with Dr. Carl, and this week we were joined by two special guests, Isabel and Ella from the Cyburst podcast. This is a podcast that looks at science through a pop culture lens, but also through the lens of solar punk. You're going to learn a little bit more about what that means, but we touched on topics like off-grid events, having hope for the future, and the fictional media that gets it right when it comes to our future and our world. We also chatted about chemtrails, primary colours, thirst, so much to tuck into. Let's get into it. Dr. Carl, you join me in the studio right now, but we have two very special guests with us. We have Isabel Richards and Ella McCarthy, who are the hosts of the Cyburst podcast. It is all about looking at science through a pop culture lens. Isabel and Ella, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much, Lucy. It's so great to be here.
Yeah, we're so excited to have you. Now, Ella, you met each other at university.
Yeah.
You know, you did science communication. How do you go from studying together, being mates at uni, to then saying, hey, we want to start a podcast? Why did you want to do that?
Well, I think it all comes from obviously a great friendship, but also a curiosity and a want to, we like to say, burst science out of the academic space and make it more relevant for other people. As science communicators studying together, we found that there were a lot of barriers to people understanding the way the world works around them. And for us, pop culture is a really great way to find something that a lot of us connect with. Mm-hmm. And talking about science through pop culture seemed like a really obvious choice together to kind of practice those science communication skills.
Yeah. Cyburst is the name of the podcast. And there was a bit of an ultimatum with you starting this podcast. It was decided that the first episode had to be about Pokemon. Now, can you tell us right here, right now, maybe a scientific anecdote about Pokemon or through the lens of Pokemon, just to get us started, just to kind of, you know, get the wheels turning a little bit?
Yeah, absolutely. So there's actually so much science going on in Pokemon. And something really interesting about the franchise as a whole is that it was created by an amateur entomologist, so someone who studies bugs.
Wow.
And insects. And the sort of the catch-em-all phrase is reminiscent of that, like, insect collecting culture in Japan too. And then there's lots of links to ecology in Pokemon. A lot of the Pokemon are actually inspired by real life bugs and have some similar characteristics. And I'm sure Ella's got a couple of facts as well that she'd like to share, because it's her favorite franchise.
Okay, so you were the one that had the ultimatum here.
Yeah, I said, Isabel, a podcast is a great idea, but Pokemon being one of my favorite things, but also the number one media franchise in the world, that's going to connect with a lot of people. So let's talk about something that a lot of people will have very strong nostalgia or love and like to play along with.
Yeah. Well, Ella, do you have a fact for us?
Okay, so one of my favorite facts is that currently there's Pokemon that get impacted by climate change in the Pokemon universe.
Wow.
So Corsola, who is a coral Pokemon, in the early games and worlds of Pokemon is bright pink. And then kind of in these later games, we're seeing that there is a Galarian Corsola who is white, and that is kind of showing that this Pokemon has been impacted by climate change.
Oh my God, almost like a coral reef or
kind of like a bleaching event has happened. Wow. So I really love this mirroring that we see in the Pokemon world that tells us a little bit more about our real world too.
Yeah. Now, Dr. Carl, have you ever heard the term solar punk?
I have not, and I am hanging by to learn.
I hadn't heard this either until I met you guys and met your podcast. So tell us about the term solar punk and what it means for the current era.
Yeah. Oh my gosh. Okay. I'm so excited to talk about solar punk and share it with new people. So basically it's this emerging genre, literary movement, artistic movement that's about how we can build hopeful, sustainable futures.
Wow.
And you might have seen kind of glimpses of it in pop culture, like Studio Ghibli movies, so Nausicaa Valley of the Wind, also the city in Black Panther, Wakanda.
Wow,
has got
yeah.
elements of it. Yeah, and so it's essentially this sustainable, hopeful future where humans, the environment, and technology are all living together in harmony.
Mm-hmm. and how we can, you know, look at this and not feel doom and gloom or...
Yeah, exactly.
And you've been looking at this in the music festival space, haven't you?
Yes, we have.
Okay, I don't want to get into that too much yet because I know that people are going to have questions about this. 0439 757 555. We've just gone down a few different avenues, a couple of movies, Pokemon, festivals. Ella and Isabel, before we launch in... Is there any particular areas that you'd want to focus on today? What kind of questions can people ask you?
Yeah, we want a whole range of different questions. We love talking about pop culture. We love talking about sustainable futures in a way that gives us hope and wants us to like interact with those questions rather than, you know, turn off and get sad about the future because there's some really great things coming up, we believe. So yeah, any questions in those realms we would absolutely love.
Okay. Dr. Carl, what's it like for you, you know, seeing people like Isabel and Ella come up through science communication and again want to push, because I feel like this is something that you kind of spearheaded as well, particularly in Australia, wanting to kind of make science communication accessible and understandable and just not, I don't know, not kind of gatekept. What's it like for you seeing others come through?
I'm loving it to pieces because we all have different areas of ignorance and my ignorance is in, for example, solar punk. I know nothing about this. Lay it on me. I'm here to learn.
Ella in Swan Hill, you've got a bit of a curly one here. Tell us about your sweat.
Okay. So I am a non-smoker of any kind, just for context. However, my sweat and all other bodily fluids smell and taste like marijuana.
Wow. Interesting. And you're wondering why this is, how this happens?
Absolutely. Okay. It's very sporadic whenever it does.
Right.
So it's not all the time. But I just can't seem to pin it down to why.
Actually, Ella, I've got a question for you. Oh, my God, we got two Ellas. I've got a question for you. Have any of your friends or your partner or family ever smelt you as well and agreed that it smells like marijuana?
Yes. Yeah, that's usually where I get it from.
Okay, wow.
People have told me.
Dr. Carl, can you speak to this at all?
Yeah, so in Australia at the moment, about 1 million people have medications of marijuana for various reasons. And so we've got a large population who can certify, yes, it does smell like marijuana. So we probably need to go to the next stage, which actually to have a test. But let's assume that it is a marijuana-like smell and there is, in fact, marijuana. Now, Dr. Ella, I just want to check. Can we exclude that somebody is secretly feeding you cannabis or that you're getting cannabis from elsewhere by accident by having the local milk, which happens to be coming from cows, which drink marijuana or eat marijuana?
Mm.
Can we exclude that?
We can exclude that, yes.
Okay, so the second possibility is related to the fact that opiates and marijuana, which are made from plants, work on humans who are made from meat. And the reason is that we make our own morphine. We call it endogenous morphine. And we shorten that word down from endogenous morphine to end orphan. We got rid of the genus and the morph. And in the same way, we have natural cannabinoids. And we discovered them working in the body about 15 years ago. And they're in everything. We didn't know. And inflammation, which is a whole big topic by itself, central nervous system maturation, oxidative phosphorylation, et cetera, et cetera. The point is we make our own cannabis or cannabinoids because we have cannabinoid receptors and they're essential. And what I'm guessing is that you're making more than the rest of us every now and then. And so are you in a capital city?
No, but Melbourne would be my closest.
Okay, so go on to a thing called Google Scholar and then type in cannabis or cannabinoid research and then you'll find a whole bunch of articles about cannabinoids and then go looking through them and you can always get the summary called the abstract for free and then just look at it and find somebody who is in Melbourne at a university.
Mm.
And then ring them up and then pretend to be nice to them and say, oh, I've read your paper on such and such and such and such, and I think that I'm producing too much natural cannabis. Would you be interested in, you know, doing some research on me?
Could be a new scientific subject, Ella.
And then you could be patient zero in a new groundbreaking research. Assuming that you're doing that, maybe one thing you could do that would be useful for them is to start a diary
of
when
down.
It happens. And then also try to diarise other things such as your diet and exercise. I can't think of anything else. Mm. And just see if they can find a pattern. And this could be a breakthrough and maybe even a Nobel Prize further down the line.
Yeah. Ella, does that help for now?
It does. Thank you, doctors. Appreciate
that. Interesting. Thank you. We've got Hannah in Melbourne. Dr. Hannah, you got a question for Ella and Isabel.
Hello, doctors. I just wanted to ask Ella and Isabel about kind of the current noise surrounding our environment feeling pretty futile. And I guess I was wondering if you could give your opinion on whether we actually feel like we have anything to be optimistic about. I know you said it before, but I guess could you dive deeper into whether we've gone too far into a negative direction to actually feel that optimism anymore?
Wow, good question.
Yeah, of course. And thank you so much for asking, because I think this is a question that makes us really passionate about exploring this subject, because I think particularly for, like, you know, younger generations, we can feel like we've grown up in this whole economy of doom and gloom and that we have to be the ones to change the future, but maybe it's too late. And it stops a lot of us engaging with these questions. Like, I don't know about you, but we feel a lot of climate anxiety or apathy kind of like throughout all our friendships and our circles. So something that we really enjoy looking at is into this world of solarpunk, which, as we've kind of touched on, is this optimistic hope for the future where we can find a balance between good human life and living comfortably with environment and with technology. And it is possible. And all the research we're looking at the moment is saying that it's not too late to turn things around. That we have a future, and all the decisions we make in our current world can lead to a better future. Mm-hmm. Now, are we kind of on the path to global warming? Yes, we are on that path, but we're still in a beautiful planet that supports human life, that we can, you know, make more efficient. We can have better diets, better transport decisions, and the world is a better place than it's ever been before. And this current book that I'm reading from Dr. Hannah Ritchie, who is one of the authors at Our World in Data, has looked at a whole huge data set. It's kind of crazy to comprehend. And she's saying this is the best time ever right now. We have the least people in percentage-wise in poverty. We have the most comfortable lives. We're making the best decisions. We've hit peak fossil fuel cars on the road. We're coming to a better spot day in, day out. And we have to keep pushing to get to a better place.
Wow. So what was this book?
I've got it with me.
It's by Hannah Ritchie.
Yeah.
Is it not the end of the world?
It's something about that.
We'll get the title of that. Dr. Carl.
I agree totally. So with regard to solar, we're hitting such a renaissance. It took 68 years to make the first terawatt of solar panels, 2 years for the second terawatt, 2 years for the third terawatt. At the moment, we are making, we the human race, and installing 1 gigawatt every 1.37 days somewhere in the world. Australia's total electrical output, if we switched everything on at once, would be 100 gigawatts, which means that if we spent 137 days installing solar in Australia, we could double our output. Mm. Secondly, there's another book, The Better Angels of Our Nature by Steven Pinker, which points out that on average we are living in the best time ever in the history of the human race with regard to war and violence. Why do you think it's so bad? Because the motto of the commercial media is, if it bleeds, it leads. And the Hannah Ritchie book is?
The Hannah Ritchie book is Not the End of the World, How We Can Be the First Generation to Build a Sustainable Planet.
Wow.
Mm. And I kind of went through the same thing back then with nuclear war, and I actually chose not to have children because we're all going to be blown up. And I went out and got my fair share of abuse and went out in demonstrations, and we did not destroy the world through nuclear war. There were three occasions where it came close, and in the same way it didn't happen then, we can get through this climate change thing.
Yeah. And I just wanted to jump in and talk about some, like, great things that are happening in energy in Australia already. So not, we're already, like, working so much towards this, like Dr. Carl was saying. But I know in the ACT, so Canberra, where Ella and I are currently living, it's 100%, our home electricity is powered by renewable energy there. In Tasmania, about 80% of the state's electricity comes from hydropower, so from water flowing through to power like turbines. And we also have a lot of wind around Australia, lots of wind corridors, which makes us great for wind energy too. So in places like South Australia and Victoria, and I know that wind energy is another cornerstone of our renewable sector, and it's generating currently about over 30% of our clean energy.
Mm.
So there's lots of great things happening around our country.
Hannah, a few things there. Is that kind of a good place to start?
Oh, that's wonderful. Thank you so much, girls. That was awesome.
If you want any of these details, they'll be available for you on the Science with Dr. Carl podcast after we air this. Jordan in Adelaide, you've kind of seen this in motion, right? You went to Lime Green Festival. How was that?
Oh, my gosh. Good morning. Hi. Yeah, we did. So myself and my girlfriend went to Lime Green Festival in Adelaide, and it was really awesome how that they kind of spruced the fact that not only did they run the festival on batteries that had been charged through renewable energy, but the really interesting thing that Ollie and Lou said that stuck out to me that I wanted to know a bit more about is in terms of their lighting design for the whole show on the stage, they mentioned that we may have noticed that a lot of the choices were reds and oranges opposed to blues. And they mentioned that that was because it was more energy efficient. And I kind of wanted to know, why is that?
Yeah. Okay. Thanks, Jordan. That's a great question. Ella and I had heard about this festival, and I'm actually really sad that we didn't get to go to this because I think we would have loved this. I know that it was a climate action festival, and I think I've got a little bit of an answer, but I think Dr. Carl might also be able to jump in and help me out a little bit. But so you said that you know that there's different wavelengths from red to blue, correct, Jordan?
Yeah, vaguely. Like, I know it's kind of a spectrum or a wave and there's the different colours, but that's where I tap out.
So what's happening is the blue light has shorter wavelengths, which is what's causing the higher energy. So the wavelengths, if you can sort of picture it in your mind, the ones that are very close together and going up and down, and then the red light is more spread out and longer wavelengths, which means that it requires less energy.
Wow. My gosh. Dr. Carl, anything to add there?
We've been heading down this pathway, and it was a 16-year-old woman at a high school in Adelaide, I forget her name, no, in Victoria, who touched a hot incandescent light bulb and realised that most of the energy was coming out as heat. We've moved over to LEDs. Instead of the old light bulb, which should have been called a heat bulb because 95% of the energy went to heat, we now have these proper light bulbs, and LEDs are the way to go. And depending on their manufacture, we can get them more efficient at different frequencies. No, it's just a much better place.
Wow. This actually reminds me as well, Billie Eilish is someone who's been doing a lot towards, you know, climate activism and climate action when it comes to live touring. And a lot of her recent shows on the Hit Me Hard and Soft tour, while the theme for a lot of them has been blue, she uses a lot of red in that show. So, Jordan, thank you so much for bringing this to our attention.
That's really awesome. Thank you so much.
Yay! Holly in Adelaide, you've been seeing something on your local community page. What's going on?
Hi, doctors. How are you?
Peachy Keen.
That's good. On my local page, they've got photos of the white lines left in the sky by planes, and they're arguing about whether they are chemtrails or contrails, and I just wanted you to confirm.
So, Dr. Carl, I've heard of chemtrails. What's contrails?
They were first seen during the Second World War when the fighters would fly at very high altitude trying to protect the bombers. And unfortunately, they'd leave behind, as a product of combustion, burning the petrol, which is what the engines ran on, they'd leave behind carbon dioxide, that's invisible, and water. You burn the hydrogen, you get water. And at certain combinations of altitude and temperature, it would freeze, leaving behind a long cotton trail or contrail, and so the bombers, the people on the ground knew, there's a little tiny aeroplane at the point of that, let's try and blow it out of the sky. So they've been around for a long time. They've now moved into chemtrails, where the claim is that all the aeroplanes of the world have these big tanks hidden, and these big tanks hold a liquid, and that liquid is added to the jet fuel and squirted out and comes out of the exhaust and falls down to the ground and makes us all happy, willing servants of the evil overlord government.
Mm.
And you can go further and you can actually buy food that is raised indoors under a glasshouse and is guaranteed to be chemtrail free. The whole thing is a con. So I've actually been to a few of the airline maintenance places and see them do what is called an A, B or C check. And they pulled the plane down to a bare shell. Mm. And I said, so what about these chemtrail you know, cylinders where you're holding the secret chemical to modify people's brains? They say, oh, they just laugh.
Mm.
They're just not there. So tell me, Holly, what's the overall vibe in your local area?
Well, it's quite a rural area, so I would say there's lots of planes flying over, and there's definitely a lot of conspiracy theorists around there. So
they incorrectly believe something. Oh dear. Oh, sorry, they believe something that is incorrect. That's hard, isn't it?
But also, Dr. Carl, you made a point off mic that, you know, we're not doing what they think it's going to do, you know? We're not all willingly...
obeying the government on everything.
Yeah.
Yes, I will vote the way you tell me to, dear government.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I have an observation to ask, an observation to share, and maybe a question for Carl, which is I've noticed that when I move from Victoria to Canberra that these beautiful white trails stay in the air suspended for a lot longer. In Victoria, where I grew up, they would disappear almost within 1 to 2 minutes. So do you know why that might be?
How long do you reckon in Canberra?
I reckon they're there for 20 minutes or longer. They hang there for quite a bit of time.
Well, they're up at around 30,000 feet, and I'm reckoning the thing that's making them change is the wind. And I have noticed with the chemtrails that they gradually spread and then become more diffuse. But what's the geography around Canberra like?
Yeah, so Canberra's pretty much in a valley and surrounded by a lot of mountains. So
the effect of that might extend to high altitudes. Is there any airline pilots? Can you please ring in on 0439 757 555?
He knows that. Holly, thanks for your question.
No worries. Thanks, guys.
Yeah, maybe you've seen something on your community page or in your group chat which you want to put to Dr. Carl, Isabel and Ella. We've got Britt in Wollongong here now. Dr. Britt, you've got a question about colour.
Yeah, I do. Hi, doctors. Hope you're doing good. Thanks for hearing me out. So I'm a painter, or I enjoy painting, but admittedly I'm not very good at it.
Oh.
And all I know is that, like, I mix blue and red and I get purple. But with primary colours, I don't really know anything other than they're primary colours because they can't be mixed any other way. That's just what you get taught in primary school. But I was wondering if there was any other science behind primary colours like yellow. You know, we can't just mix yellow with the paints that we have at home, and we know that, but what's the science behind that? Like, why can't we make yellow?
Ah, so you got to realise the magic word gamut, G-A-M-U-T, and look it up on Wikipedia, and it has many meanings, one of which is the range of possible colours that can be manufactured by mixing together the three primary colours. That's the first thing. The second thing, there's two sets of primary colours. If you're mixing together lights, in other words, a TV screen, the primary colours are red, green and blue. And then you can mix blue and green to make yellow. But if you're mixing dyes, you're in a whole different world. It's called subtractive. And there, you get the primary colours by looking at the inkjet ink, which is CMY, cyan, yellow and magenta. So there's two different sets of primary colours. When you're dealing with paint, you're dealing with CMY, and you're dead right. You cannot manufacture yellow by mixing any other dyes, but you can manufacture yellow by mixing different lights, but you can't transfer that onto the screen. And the two gamuts are slightly different. They're very similar, but they don't quite overlap. And so there are certain colours that you can see with the eye from a dye that cannot appear on a TV screen. And one of those is the super bright tradie clothes that they wear.
Oh.
You can see that in real life. Take a photograph of it and look at it coming as light from the screen towards you, being mixed on the screen with lights, and you don't get the same thing. So there are certain colours that will not come across that are, you know, unique to either dyes or lights. So remember, there's two different primary colours and the magic word is gamut. We've given you some homework. I'm sorry.
Yeah, Brent.
Oh.
And keep up the painting. I love this.
Yeah. Oh, thank you. I will.
Hey, thanks, Brent. We got Josh in Newcastle. Josh, you got a question for Ella and Isabel. What do you want to know?
Hey, doctors. How's it going?
Good.
Yeah, good, good, good. I want to know what their favourite interpretation or, like, way a movie or pop culture has actually gotten the future right.
Oh, yeah. So I'll go first. There's a really great duology. So it's two novellas by an author called Becky Chambers, who's written quite a bit of science fiction. And the two books are called, well, the series is called the Monk and Robot series. And the first one is called a, help me out, Ella. One is called A Psalm for the Wild Built. And then, oh yeah, that's right. The first one is called A Psalm for the Wild Built. And then the second one is called A Prayer for the Crown Shy. And it's this beautiful solarpunk world where it's actually this future where they used to have robots, but the robots sort of developed a consciousness and were like, actually, humans don't need us anymore, and sort of went into the forests and disappeared for hundreds of years. And then and they're like always sort of having conversations, these robots, with each other. And then one of them sort of comes to this realization of, oh, maybe it's time to go and check back in with the humans, with the questions of what do humans need. And so it's this really beautiful story of this robot going on this lovely journey with the main character Dex and learning about humans and what they're doing. And I want to also say that this future is set in a place where everything is operated on renewable energy. There's lots of eco-villages. Everybody, wow, like, kind of rides their bike everywhere.
There's not a monetary system.
There's no monetary system.
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah, so that would be my favorite.
Ella, what do you reckon?
So I'm going to jump us into the world of Star Trek, the mega text of science fiction that encompasses all the TV shows, the movies, the books. And if you haven't ever seen Star Trek before, you don't have to be like the nerdiest person on earth to enjoy it. I swear, I promise. It's really cool. It takes place largely in the future and largely on spaceships, and it's been described as both post-colonial and utopian. And the reason I bring it up is because it interacts so much with our current world. So the reason that tablets and iPads exist in the first place is because this technology was first imagined on the original Star Trek shows in the 60s.
Wow, yeah.
So they had a handheld computer called a pad, P-A-D-D. That is directly where iPad gets its name from. And also on this show, we saw for the first time communicators, which look a lot like early mobile phones. And in fact, for flip phones, were the exact inspiration for how they were designed.
Oh my gosh.
So they were kind of playing with these ideas of what does it mean to communicate in the future? What types of information sharing systems do we want? And there's so much that can be learned from this interplay of science fiction and reality that I really, really love.
Yeah.
And that's so much more inspiring than a lot of the current genre, which doesn't show much imagination, unlike the stories that you've mentioned. And in these stories, it's very simple. It's the future, the wealthy control everything, the poor are screwed, you're going to die soon, and it rains a lot.
We just had a question about chemtrails. Anthony in Toowoomba, you said, I found in London when I was there a long time ago, the contrails seemed to last for ages. Maybe colder climate, but you would see some days contrails crisscrossed in the sky. Matt, you said lingering jet trails are a reliable weather observation for an incoming change. Lower air pressure, they remain. Higher, they disappear.
You learn something every day.
Interesting.
That was Matt.
That was Matt, yeah.
Thank you, Dr. Matt.
Hey, let's go to Kiama. We've got Martin. Martin, what's your question?
Good morning, doctors. Just curious, that would Australia be affected by nuclear fallout?
Yes and no, depending on how big the nuclear exchange was. Isn't that a nice, polite word? So back then we had something called the MAD, which stood for Mutually Assured Destruction. And basically it was, you put one nuclear weapon on my country, I'll put 20,000 on yours, and the rest of the world will be collateral damage. It was kind of like two old men standing in a swimming pool up to their necks in petrol, and one had six burning matches and the other one had seven burning matches, and one with seven said, I win. So if we had only a few nuclear weapons go off, the overwhelming majority of the nuclear fallout would be confined to whatever hemisphere they were set off in, probably the northern hemisphere. Around the equator, there's something called the ITCZ, Intertropical Convergence Zone. And in the old days, when they had sailing ships, they called it the horse latitudes, because if they were taking horses across from the UK to India and they got becalmed there because there was no wind, they'd throw the horses overboard and let them die. And then So there's not much movement across the equator. There is some, but not a huge amount. If there was, you know, a few thousand nuclear weapons went off, it'd be a very bad day for everybody. You'd lose electricity, life expectancy would go down, and it would cross the equator. There's a movie on this called On the Beach, and there's a book by Neville Shute called On the Beach as well.
Yeah. Yeah, I saw it. Amazing. Yeah.
Thanks, Martin.
But I think we'll get through climate change just the way we got through nuclear holocaust. We will avoid it.
Hey, Matt in Geelong, you've got a question about temperature. What have you noticed?
G'day, guys. So, camping, I noticed the moon's light seemed to make me feel colder as the moon rose over the horizon. I had a thermometer in the shadows, and I noticed the temperature, and as the moon moved, the light struck it, and it did indeed drop in temperature, and I'm trying to figure out why.
Ah, I've actually read on this with the clever people in astronomy, and they've said that the moon is a reflector, and there is an ever-so-tiny increase in temperature between a full moon and not, and so what you're probably observing is a local effect. Maybe a wind current, maybe the fact that the air's cooling down because the sun's not providing heat. So in general, the moon raises the temperature, I think, by maybe a tenth of a degree or a hundredth of a degree. It's really small. If somebody can look it up and text us on 0439 757 555, we'd love to know the number.
Matt, did you plan to take a thermometer with you? Why did you have that on hand?
Why?
It wasn't mine. It was somebody else's. And you can get them for camping. You have internal and external temperatures. It keeps a track of the extremes in the last 24 hours.
Oh, great gear. Matt, thank you so much for texting in. Eliza in Perth, what's your question this morning?
Morning, doctors. I have a question about babies. I had the same question 2 years ago, and it's still on my mind 2 years later now that I've had my second one. As adults, we know the difference between the parched thirst sensation and a tummy hunger sensation. When a baby cries and they want to be fed, is it because they're thirsty or hungry? Where's that message coming from?
Ah, so the babies are born just barely able to survive and you've got to look after them and they're kind of 3 months earlier, but we couldn't keep them cooking for another 3 months because you couldn't get them out through the birth canal. And so they don't have the proper melatonin production and they don't know when to sleep. And in their early days, the thinking is that they've just got a general me hungry, thirsty, and the two are joined together. And around 6 months, a process called interoception begins to kick in. And suddenly their senses become a little bit more neurologically mature. And suddenly they can differentiate, oh, I'm seeing light versus dark, and I'm seeing the colours better, and I can now recognise hunger from thirst. And the thing is that the babies know the difference around 6 to 12 months, but they can't actually... Nice noise.
That's a fine. Yeah. Plane in the background.
But they can't say it to you. So what you can do is teach the babies sign language.
And which I did with my first one.
Oh, you did that? Good on you. How did you find that worked?
Amazing. He's 2 and doesn't speak very well but can sign everything he needs to tell us.
Wow.
Well, I do remember in my medical training we were taught about a young child called Jock, called Angus, who didn't say any words at all until he was 4 years old. And when he was 4 years old, he turned to his brother and said, and this is the first thing he ever said because the brother was crying, "What aileth thee, Jock?"
What?
There's no point in talking because there's nothing to say.
Yeah.
So the thing is that so for the first 6 months, they don't really differentiate, we think. It's hard to talk to them and get good answers.
I kind of have a follow-up question to this, Dr. Carl, around the sort of the thirst sensation thing, because I find that even as an adult, I sometimes don't, my body doesn't actually give me the thirst cues. And so I think that I'm hungry. So I'll get the tummy hunger sensation. And so I've had to like learn over the period of years that sometimes that hunger sensation actually is my body telling me to drink water. So I make sure I drink water first before I eat. I'm wondering if there's some science behind that.
Yes. None of our systems are perfect and you do have a system for thirst sensation. And sometimes you mistake that, and this happened to me too, for hunger. So What happens to you if you neither eat nor drink? What happens to your mental state?
I get headaches.
Wow. And you can be fixed by having a drink.
Yes.
Sometimes. That's all we need. Hey, we got Peter in Narangba here. Peter, what's your question? You want to talk us through a movie?
Yeah, it's the anime One Piece. In it, they have people that are all different sizes, from like people that would fit in your hand up to ones that are hundreds of feet tall. And one of them is a mermaid who'd be, I don't know, 150 feet tall.
Wow.
When she talks, she has a little girl's voice. And I was just wondering, is that accurate, or would they have a really deep voice the bigger they got?
Okay. Isabel, Ella, take us into your world, you know, of transposing science into, you know,
art.
Pop culture into art. What do you think? Do you think that's accurate?
Yeah. So what I'm thinking right now with my background in biological anthropology is, how on earth are all of our body systems in humans, like we said before, they're not precise and there's actually quite a lot of specialized equipment we have going on in here. How on earth is that working, like you said, in One Piece, from people of all sizes all the way up to this 100-foot tall mermaid? And what I love about fiction is that it allows us to explore these types of questions. And I actually don't know if there's any scientific backing to it, but I would be really intrigued to know if there is anything in the anime you've heard, Peter, where it explains why these people are different sizes. Did something happen in a lab? Was there a mix-up? Do we know why these characters are all sorts of shapes and sizes?
It's just the world that they live in. There's little tiny people and giants and people that live in the sky and all kinds of crazy stuff. So they never really give any explanation as to anything, but some of the giants talk with really deep voices, but then the girl ones talk with little Japanese girl type voices, you know. And I just wondered whether the way the air goes through your vocal cords would mean that there's no way they would sound like the normal little people.
Well, kind of like that, but ish. So on one hand, a lion can have a terribly low frequency sound, and you're thinking, okay, it's a big guy, but then why doesn't a giraffe sound even lower? And so it's more than just the length of the vocal tract. There are other factors involved. And secondly, talking about different sizes, people are finally beginning to understand, and we haven't got there yet, why there's a certain type of hallucinogenic mushroom where everybody has the same hallucination, which is you see people roughly the length of your hand from the fingertip to the base of your wrist. And we don't know why, but we're getting closer to understand. Maybe they can flow that into anime.
Oh, my gosh. Okay, well, you actually tackle the word of anime in your podcast at different points. Cyburst, Isabel, Ella, you've joined us on this week's episode. What is one takeaway you want people to have about maybe looking at science in pop culture or about, you know, solar punk? Ella, we'll start with you.
Yeah, I'd love people to question the amazing and your favorite forms of popular culture and media that you take in. Something that I've noticed is pretty much every single superhero has powers as a direct result of science, technology, engineering, or math. So I'd encourage you all to walk away from here and think about how science is actually really integrated in all your favorite things.
Isabel?
Yeah, I think I'm going to go more the solar punk route and remind people that to think about the sort of news media that they're reading, and because a lot of the news media will focus on the bad stories because that's what's going to get clicks, unfortunately. But there are lots of places you can go to actually get some good news stories about the climate, about scientific breakthroughs. And so I would really encourage people to sort of start being intentional about looking for those sources.
And we can do both of those things by listening to Cyburst. Your podcast is available right now wherever people get their podcasts. Thank you so much for jumping ship for a second, coming on Science with Dr. Carl.
Oh, thanks for inviting us.
Yeah, we love being here.
Yay. Yeah. Thanks, Isabel. Thanks, Ella. Dr. Carl, I'll catch you next week.
Peachy keen.
And that's it. Thanks again to Isabel Richards and Ella McCarthy for joining us on this week's episode of Science with Dr. Carl. We'll pop their details and their podcast for you in the show notes. Next week, we're going to have two more special guests for NAIDOC Week. NAIDOC Week kicks off this Sunday. It is 50 years of Deadly. And to celebrate, we've got two friends of the show coming through, Corey Tudd to talk all things animals and Crystal DiNapoli, an astrophysicist. So if you've got any animal or astrophysics space questions, feel free to send them in via our Google Doc. You can get in early. That is also going to be linked in the show notes. Be listening next week, Thursday, 9 a.m. Australian Eastern Standard Time, if you want to send in a question live for our Science with Dr. Carl NAIDOC Week special. I'm Lucy Smith. This episode was produced by Matteo Bascarin, and we'll catch you next week. Bye.
Dave Marchese here from the Triple J Hack team. Hey, if you love Dr. Carl's podcast like I do, you might enjoy the Hack podcast as well. Each day, we bring you the news that matters to you, from the latest science on climate change to what's happening in politics and news around the world. The Hack Podcast. It's your daily fix of the news you need to know. Get it wherever you're listening now.